This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tonight, President Bush fulfills one of the duties required of him by the Constitution. He will report on the State of the Union. Though most of our early presidents sent Congress a written report, in this century they've mostly seized the chance to occupy the national spotlight. Some use this grand occasion to announce bold initiatives. Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, for example, and Ronald Reagan's promise not to balance the budget on the backs of the taxpayers. But many longtime political observers say they can't remember a more momentous occasion than tonight. Depending on how you look at it, President Bush has the challenge or the opportunity to address a host of pressing issues, domestic and foreign. Later this hour, we'll talk with two former State of the Union speechwriters about the style and structure of this annual address, and we want to hear from you. Tonight, when you listen to President Bush, will you want to hear specific details, a to-do list that addresses your particular issue? Or are you listening for a broader vision of the country's future? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now to help frame our discussion is NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Always good to have you here in Studio 3A.
Good to be here, Neil.
We hear that this is going to be the most important speech, it seems, every year.
And it's also the latest edition of the most important speech of George W. Bush's life. We've already seen that several times. I do think it's more important than the average one because there really is a moment of crisis for the Bush program, for the president's view of Iraq, for his view of homeland security and the war on terror and so on. We seem to have reached another point where the momentum is sputtering a little bit, as it was at the early part of last summer before we started to focus on Iraq. And they also, I think the president wants to use this moment to take the initiative back with respect to a number of economic and other domestic issues. The stimulus package, sometimes so-called, his own budget coming up next week, the tax cuts that he's pushing, and, of course, a long list of other things that he wants to have be his legacy as president on a number of fronts, not the least of which would be prescription drugs for seniors and Medicare reform in general. So there's just a great number of things the president needs to take to the country and also, obviously, to Congress, and this is the best opportunity he could have.
There has been a lot of analysis in the past several weeks in many different fora about the character of President Bush and his presidency and the determination that 2 years into office, this is not a cautious man. This is a guy who wants to swing for the fences.
I think that he has seen in his own lifetime experience that the presidents who did so were the presidents who got the most done. And while they might have failed at times, by attempting great things, they were able to achieve some things. And I think Ronald Reagan is really the model of his presidency. It's actually become kind of almost a cliche in recent months to say that he's much more using Ronald Reagan as his model than he's using his own father's presidency as his model. But this is the way he feels more comfortable governing, setting out a large program, a large, bold vision, if you will. And then, if you have to deal with Congress in the details at the last minute, fine, you can concede a little bit. But don't open with concessions. You always want to go forward with as much head of steam as you can.
As you mentioned, the presidency has hit a bit of a rough spot in the polls. If you would say the worst rating you get is 54%, if you count that as a rough spot, most presidents would be happy with that. Nevertheless, as some put it, in the past few days, people in the White House have had their first glimpse of political mortality.
Well, it needs to be said that Ronald Reagan was considerably lower than 54% when he was at a comparable point in his presidency, went on to win 49 states. And President Bush I was at a much higher point in popularity but went on to lose his reelection bid. So those numbers are not necessarily an indication of what the president's political mortality might be. But this much is true: when you have gone to the height of 90% approval, and when you have been over 80% approval for 6 months, and over 60% approval for 15 months, to be down in the low 50s probably does feel a little chilly.
It used to be that one of the most obscure positions any politician could ever hope to occupy is that of giving the opposition party's rebuttal to the State of the Union message. This is a dutifully broadcast and widely ignored spot. Nevertheless, this year the Democrats are trying a different tactic. Yesterday at the National Press Club, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and Minority House Leader Nancy Pelosi gave a Democratic pre-buttal tonight. tonight's State of the Union address, and let's listen to just a snatch of it. Here's Senator Daschle's take on what he thinks he'll be hearing from the Bush White House.
While promising relief to hard-pressed middle-class families, the White House delivers a reward to wealthy investors. While promising new accountability and responsibility to government, the White House runs up huge deficits and then blames it on the war. While promising to protect homeland, the White House blocks billions of dollars to fund first responders and other homeland security priorities. While promising to promote diversity, the White House files a lawsuit to prevent a university from achieving it.
Senator Daschle addressing what he called the credibility gap that has developed, a phrase that goes back to, Watergate and Nixon days. At the same time, this is a new tactic to get the message out early.
I think it's probably savvy because, as you say, very few people listen to that rebuttal that comes after the president. One exception to it I can think of was in 1985, right after Ronald Reagan had been reelected. The Democrats turned for their response speech to a young and at that time obscure governor from Arkansas named Bill Clinton, who actually did a rather remarkable job at laying out a precursor look at his own politics of the 1990s. It was pretty effective in 85, and it served him well later on. I don't necessarily see that for Gary Locke. I don't necessarily see his future, including two terms as president, or any of the other things we associate with Bill Clinton. But I do think it's become a kind of almost consolation prize. In a sense, it's nice. It's a way to get a little national exposure, but it doesn't really launch anyone on a rocket. So the Democrats, Tom Daschle and the Democratic leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, were smart to go right out and get a little bit of press on their own this morning, because they're not going to get much no matter what they do tomorrow morning.
On Iraq, an awful lot of people have been asking the president, where's the proof you should use this national, indeed international, spotlight to provide the country and the world with the smoking gun? The administration says he will be addressing Iraq tonight, but should we be expecting details?
I don't think we should be expecting either a great deal of minor detail or a great deal of fine detail, or on the other hand, should we be expecting something that is terribly dramatic. If they had either one, we probably would have seen it previously, or we would have at least had some indication that it was forthcoming. There may be a time when they see fit to do that. I suspect it would be a little closer to the moment of invasion that we would actually see that. They obviously have reasons in their own mind for why they've withheld that information up to now.
Well, Senator Daschle asked for it again yesterday, and we're told that perhaps Secretary of State Powell may provide it as late as soon as maybe next week to the United Nations. But why would he delegate that to the Secretary of State necessarily?
I think it's all a matter of what they think it's tactically and strategically sensible for them to do at a given moment. And they don't see this as the material of a State of the Union address, and they're also trying to hold it close to the vest as long as they can for the purpose of protecting intelligence sources.
Are presidents generally held to account for what they say at the State of the Union address, or amid the long laundry list of projects and things that they would like to get done, are most things forgotten?
Well, journalists like to play back the tape, and we like to ask whatever happened to this and what happened to that, and we comment on it and we write about it. I'm not sure that the average citizen has enough faith in the political process that they would even go to the lengths of doing that. I think they regard a lot of this stuff rather cynically, which is why the president's better off with some kind of overarching idea than with a lot of fine detail.
We're going to take a phone call now. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And Tamara joins us on the line from San Mateo, California.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I wanted to know what your panel or your visitor thinks of this. Those high approval numbers that George Bush has had so far, in my opinion, are not so much a reflection of the general population's approval of what he is doing, but rather just a show of solidarity with the country during a hard time and of patriotism. I think people just want to kind of stick together and, you know, give the guy in charge some support, even though they might not actually agree with him. And I wondered what you thought of that.
Well, there's a lot of precedent for that. In Ronald Reagan's term, oftentimes his positions on issues were not the positions of a majority of the people who were polled about those same issues, but people still stood by Ronald Reagan, and I think that Ronald Reagan and all the people around him were pretty happy to settle for that. If you look at certain policy issues now, for example, unilateral invasion of Iraq as opposed to UN-supported invasion, that does not have very high approval in the public prints. The public polls, I've seen 33% as a low point, something up around 40% in some other polls. So that's certainly not what you'd call strong support for an issue. But across the board, I think the president, going back to the November 2002 election and the success a lot of Republican candidates have had, was speaking for the views of a great number of Americans other than the hardcore Republican base. I think he reached out to a lot of people in the middle.
Tamara, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And Ron Elving, thanks very much for you. Always appreciate your coming in to join us all the way from your office. A good six steps away from here? Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor. He'll be working on tonight's State of the Union address. We are previewing the State of the Union message and taking your phone calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email. Our address is totn@npr.org. By the way, later in the hour, we're going to be talking about new information on the terrorist group that plotted the 9/11 attacks. We'll also have a short discussion about an interesting election today in Oregon on raising taxes. But right now, we're going to be joined by two former speechwriters. Bob Boorstein is here with us in Studio 3A. He worked for the Clinton administration for 7 years. And David Frum, the author of The Right Man, joins us from the CBC studios in Washington. He was a member of the Bush administration and helped write last year's State of the Union message. Bob Boorstein, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
And David Frum, very nice of you to join us.
Thank you.
Wanted to ask you is, what do you think is the greatest challenge that the president is going to be facing this evening amid all of the things that Ron Elving and so many other people have said that he needs to address? At the same time, you want to address a lot of different things. You also want to keep the message focused. Is that right, David Frum?
I think he does. I think his greatest challenge is going to be the domestic side of the speech. I mean, the country really has rallied to President Bush's leadership on international affairs, and I think they are with him on what he wants to do about terrorism, and they're prepared to be with him on Iraq if he really believes it's necessary. The danger for this president in this somewhat more liberal era than Republicans dominated back in the 1980s is the public's not completely with the Republican Party on many domestic issues. So he has to show the folks that he has not forgotten that side of his responsibilities, that he does have ideas about what to do about the recession, or the continuing slow growth, and that also that he hasn't forgotten about health care, because in an economy like this, most people are pretty confident that even if they lose their jobs, they can, in good order, find another one. What they're really worried about is the loss of a job may mean the loss of health coverage.
Bob Boorstein, same question to you.
Well, the problem with the State of the Union has always been that it becomes kind of a Christmas tree speech in which everybody gets to hang their own ornament on it. In the somewhat disciplined Bush White House, at least from what we read, that shouldn't be as big of a problem. And with any luck, he'll have some real luck at pushing forward a theme. His problem, as David has outlined, is that he has to go in two directions at once. He's got to convince people about the economy and that he cares about the economy, of which there is very little evidence. And he has to address the question of why should we go to war.
We want to hear from you in this discussion. Are you going to be interested in Bob Boorstein just referred to as one of those Christmas ornaments, one of those issues, some individual item that you're really looking to see whether it's included in the State of the Union address tonight, whether that be help on prescription medicine or health care or some other specific issue, or whether you're looking for a more broader vision of where the country is headed and what the president sees in our future? Give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And a few minutes later, we're also going to be talking with a longtime observer of the State of the Union address from Germany, man who normally covers this as sort of an interesting American domestic issue. Europe is going to be looking much more closely tonight at the State of the Union message. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the work and the thought that goes into a State of the Union address. Two former speechwriters are with us. Bob Boorstin is here in Studio 3A. He worked in the Clinton administration for 7 years. David Frum is the author of The Right Man, and he's with us from the CBC studios in Toronto. He worked in the Bush White House and helped write last year's State of the Union message. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And David Frum, based on what happened last year, what's going on at the White House right now?
Well, this year is going to be, I think, a little different from last year in that just because of the Blix report, the speech will not be wrapped up quite as early. President Bush likes to get speeches fixed and finished early so he can practice, but he also doesn't like to second guess. This year, there's a lot of news coming in at the very last minute. The administration has to be ready to respond to it. Mm-hmm. But I think they've had a pretty good idea of what's going to be coming from the Blix report. It's no news that Iraq is not complying with the UN resolutions. It's no news either that the inspectors want to give Iraq lots more time in which not to comply, it's certainly important that that be confirmed, and the speech may need to be tweaked here or there, but I think they've anticipated are in good shape.
How much does President Bush himself, how much of a hand does he like to have in a speech like this?
He likes to give strong direction at the beginning about what he wants to say and what he doesn't want to say, which is just as important. He checks the process as it goes along, and then he edits very seriously at the end of the process, but he doesn't like to constantly be fooling around and changing. He likes things to go in a very orderly way, and once he's made up his mind, he really is finished. I understand that President Clinton, for example, and some other recent presidents like to continue to edit up to the very last minute. President Bush does not like to do that.
Well, Bob Boorstin, is that right? Is President Clinton editing up until the last minute?
Yeah, up until the last second, you could even say.
Yeah, he ad-libbed some of it?
Yep, he went off script. The president was capable of doing that, of course. And there are other people who need to have that script in front of them at all times in order to make sure that they're using the right rhetoric.
Unlike other speeches, though, as you mentioned, this is a real collective effort by everybody, not just in the administration, in the White House, but in the government. Every branch of the government wants to have its idea, its thought, its moment in this speech.
Yeah, that's right. And what you get is a series of cabinet secretaries and their officials coming at you if you're a speechwriter. You feel under assault for several weeks, and everybody has an exact number or an exact program or something that they think is absolutely vital for everyone in the nation to hear. We took at one point to trying to separate what the president would say from what was actually delivered to Congress. And so we would deliver a written message in which we would expand on certain things or put in programs that weren't mentioned.
I have to ask, you mean there was a version that was even longer?
Yes.
Let's go to the phones and hear about some of the issues. Again, 800-989-8255. And Jose is our first caller. He's on the line from Fort Lauderdale.
How's it going?
Okay.
Oh, well, I guess I'd like to hear a couple of things. I'd like to hear President Bush say more about the tax cuts and how he's going to advocate for them. I really think that we'd go a lot farther in our economy if the government would step down and kind of put to bed some of those welfare programs and let us keep more of our money. Also, I'd like to hear him talk about Iraq and how we should take out a dictator and put him out of, get rid of that regime, and maybe even hear a little bit more about how Iran and the role that it's played in that axis of evil, and maybe start thinking about, I'd like to hear him say if he has any intentions of going after them. And from what I've read, they do a lot of work for the terrorists. They support them quite a bit, and there's a lot of fundamental extremism that comes out of there.
It sounds, Jose, as if you're more interested in that big picture stuff rather than, the details.
Right.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
David Frum, it's interesting. Is it easier, and I'm going to ask you both this, is it easier to write stuff where you're advocating, something new or spending something, or is it easier to write about something that you want to pull back from? I mean, again, you go back to the example of Ronald Reagan, and he made spending cuts a very important part of his messages.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to hear a lot about that tonight. Look, what it really takes above all is the discipline to leave things out. I mean, there is truly no limit as to how long these speeches can be. And it takes extraordinary self-control and control over the process of government to be able to say, I mean, I recognize exactly the scenario that Bob was describing a minute ago. And it takes great discipline to be able to say, look, these are important programs. There will be an opportunity to talk about them later. But this is an administration with clear priorities. And the top 1, 2, 3, and 4 are this. That's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And I think Jose, for example, just called us going to have a very good evening, because I think that the priorities he's identified are precisely the priorities the president's going to want to talk about.
Yeah. And Bob, I have the same question to you.
Well, I would agree largely with what David said. I think the president actually succeeded, if you go back and look at last year's State of the Union, because he managed to cram into one paragraph all sorts of issues like the environment and other things that are perhaps not his top priorities. And I thought that was a very effective way to address those things that otherwise would take up a lot of time and you'd get a lot of details.
Let's go back to the phones, and our next caller is Mark, who's on the line from Detroit.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well.
I'd like to hear him again, probably say some specific things about the economy. I know when he talked last year, he said that the measures that he'd already taken would stimulate the economy and this economic downturn would be short-lived, but that's obviously those measures missed the mark. So I'd like to hear him talk specifically. The only thing I hear from the plans that people talk about now is not taxing dividends on stocks, and they talk that would bring about $600 billion out of the economy. I would consider myself an upper-middle-class person, and I know I don't have any dividends to speak of that would benefit me, so I don't see that as being a particularly beneficial approach. So I would like to hear him talk about some other measures.
Bob, let's go to you first on this. You know, is it easy to go back to what you said a year ago? Can the president say, you know, we would have if Congress had just done what I wanted them to?
Well, the president has a problem. That is, the facts don't match his promises. Last year, he said that the deficit would be small and short term. And now we are facing a deficit of what some people estimate to be $300 billion. And Mark should know that he's not alone. Most of the Democratic leaders, if not all, and several of the very important Republican leaders have come out against, if not tepidly, come out against this dividend tax. I think the president has a very, very hard sell on the economy.
David, in your book, you said that particularly in events like this, the president doesn't debate, the president doesn't rebut. That's not the president's role.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that is the power of the presidency is you do get to make your case, and people just, I mean, the fact that the president believes it makes it powerful. He asserts. And so when the president says that this or that is my priority, that carries weight. But he has to, I mean, he has to match his priorities with those of the public, obviously. He's going to be in trouble. And on the economy, it's true. The economy has turned out to be much more sluggish than people hoped it would turn out to be a year ago. It's got a lot of problems. Terrorism is one of the problems. It's probably one of the two or three very biggest problems, because it is the fear of the future that has weighed so heavily on financial markets, that has depressed the values of corporate assets. That's one of the things the dividend tax cut is supposed to redress. I mean, Mark may not get much in the way of dividends, but I suspect, like most middle-class people, he does have an ownership stake in many, many companies, either directly or indirectly. Those companies will be more valuable after this tax cut. That'll have an impact on financial markets, which is really where the problems of the economy are today concentrated.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go now to Robert, and Robert's in Los Angeles.
Hello. On the subject, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. On the subject here of what I'm looking for from President Bush and the State of the Union tonight, the Iraq thing is huge, obviously. And there's two things. I'll try to be real concise. One, what is going to be this administration's view towards nation building? Is he going to talk about democracy in Iraq? And I mean, I think that's huge. The second item is, what about the oil? You know, there's hundreds of thousands of people who've been protesting that this is a war about oil, not just in the United States, but all over Europe and in much of the other parts of the world. And I think that this administration has got to convince people that Well, here's what I'd like them to say. I mean, some are going to, you know, I'm sure somebody's going to criticize me for wishful thinking or whatever. But I think that the administration should say this is absolutely not about oil. That the Iraqi people ought to be reserved the right in a post Saddam Hussein Iraq, that they ought to be reserved the right to nationalize the oil so that Iraq doesn't become another Saudi Arabia. And that's pretty much the two things I'm going to be looking for with this potential war coming up, and I can take my comments off the air.
Well, just quickly, Robert, those questions almost presume that you take not only the war, but a victory in a war as a given.
I think it's likely that we would probably win soon, and then all hell's really going to break loose.
Okay. Well, all right. Thanks very much, Robert. Bob?
Yeah, let me just say that I think Robert may be disappointed tonight, because one of the things that's most interesting is what President Bush won't say tonight. You will not hear the phrase axis of evil, I am pretty sure. You will not hear about nation building and the long-term cost of rebuilding Iraq, both economically and politically, because it's a swamp, and it's one of those swamps that the Bush administration is going to have trouble facing up to and certainly doesn't want to tell the public about before we go to war. And I don't think you'll hear about oil. I think you will hear the usual platitude about moving to remove our dependence on Middle Eastern oil, but I don't think he'll go much past that.
David Frum?
I don't think I agree with that. I think this administration's planning for the after war is very advanced. I think most people in the administration believe that this war will be swift and that it will be relatively bloodless on both sides. The difficulties that Bob says are afterwards, and those do have to be talked about. I mean, Iraq is a danger in itself, but it's also part of the hope for a Middle East which is less vulnerable to terrorism. And I would certainly hope, I would expect that President Bush would say something about that tonight, and maybe more later, about how we are going to try to make Iraq a better place. As this point about war for oil, I have to say I get very impatient with it. Right now, Iraq doesn't have any oil. A dictator has oil, and he takes the vast billions of wealth generated by that oil and uses it to buy weapons for himself and palaces and Mercedes-Benz motor cars. No Iraqi in his right mind would say, I'd rather skip the roads, skip the clinics, skip the schools, skip the water projects, and spend the money on weapons. Only after Iraq is liberated will that oil ever again belong to the people of Iraq. As for Robert, that oil has been nationalized in Iraq for 30 years. That's the reason that industry is so retrograde. I think a free Iraq would understand that nationalized industries don't work very well and that you want to welcome advanced foreign investment, not for America's benefit, but for Iraq, so that the oil will be more lucrative and pay for a better life for the people of Iraq. On nation building, you know, we don't usually say this in politics, but, and I think probably the president won't go quite as far as this, sometimes, though, it is a good idea to say, you know what, we thought something and we were wrong. And we Republicans are very disparaging of the term nation building. What we really meant was we didn't think Somalia and Haiti were appropriate places in which to build nations. Those weren't top problems. But maybe our rhetoric was too strong, because we now do confront the very center of Arab nationalism, the place from which so much extremism has come, Iraq. We have to do it right, and nation building is going to be part of our mandate there. I don't think the president will want to use the word, but I think he is very comfortable with the idea.
And obviously this is a continuing obligation to Afghanistan as well, and one of our email questioners writes to ask if we're going to hear the name of Osama bin Laden tonight. Bob, what do you think?
I think the only way that you'll hear that name is that we're in pursuit of him and all of the people who are doing his work all over the world. And I do think that, you know, they'll be able to point, the president will be able to point to several people who have been taken into custody and so forth.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now from his office in McLean, Virginia, is Siegfried Buchluter. He's the Washington Bureau Chief of Deutschland Radio. He's covered the last 9 State of the Union addresses, and very nice of you to join us today.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Will you be covering this differently from the way you've covered previous State of the Union addresses?
Well, as you said, this will be the 9th State of the Union speech I've covered, and most of them dealt with domestic politics, front and center. And while there's always been a certain amount of interest among my listeners in what the president said about the economy, about health care, about other domestic issues, they weren't exactly excited about it. And most people want to know whether they are affected by what happens in America or by what American presidents do. And I think this time it's different because of Iraq. And because people want to know whether there is going to be war with Iraq, when and why.
given the time differences, few in Europe will be, relatively few, will be listening to the president live or for that matter, to the entirety of what he has to say. So they will be very reliant on what they hear from you and read in their newspapers and that sort of thing. What is it in particular that the German people are going to be interested in hearing? What are you going to focus on?
I think what they want to hear from the president is whether he's made the decision, whether America will wait for another UN resolution, whether the administration will work for another resolution, whether America will go it alone, in a coalition of the willing, which willy-nilly would turn out to be fairly small, and if America goes to war, why now? Of course, these are basically the same questions lots of Americans ask and expect to be answered tonight.
Siegfried Buchluter, thanks very much for being with us, and good luck tonight.
Thank you.
Siegfried Buchluter, Washington Bureau Chief of Deutschland Radio, and he spoke with us from his office in McLean, Virginia. Let's get another phone call. Alex is on the line from Seattle.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have is, I'm behind with the president all the way going to war in Iraq, but I want to see the connection that they're making. I'm kind of puzzled why now this the link between the Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime. I mean, if they were connected, how come they didn't use the mass destruction weapon, all these kind of things before? Why coming out now? And I wanted to see the exit strategy from the war.
David, we just have a couple of minutes left. Alex, thanks very much for the phone call, and it's a very good question. Clearly, there is an awful lot of jitteriness about the prospect of a new war.
Well, it's the same war. It's a new front in the same war, and that's the point the president, I think, is going to make. There is jitteriness, but I think on foreign policy matters, this president has really earned the trust of the American people, and his poll numbers may move around a little bit, but Americans are, on these big issues of war and peace, I think fundamentally willing to trust him.
Bob Borstein, has the president convinced us that this is the same war?
Well, I don't think he's gone far enough in convincing us, and he certainly has not, he or no anybody else in the administration has presented the evidence. Look, the president has a big dilemma tonight. He and Karl Rove and others in the White House used 9/11, they used the possibility of war in Iraq to win the election in November. And now tonight, we get to see how they plan to follow up on that. They have a big question to answer, and the question is why.
And that leaves Alex's other question wide open, and that's exit strategy, and that's, I think we're going to be talking about that one for a long time. Anyway, thanks very much to you both. David Frum, appreciate your time.
Thank you.
David Frum was with us from the CBC studios in Toronto. He's the author of The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush. And Bob Borstein was here in Studio 3A with us.
Thank you.
Vice President of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner, a Democratic polling firm, and appreciate you taking the time.